This is
MVP Days 2017 coming to you live from Edmonton, Calgary, Alberta.
This is one of
our last sessions of the day. We have the fantastic number one best-selling author, all-around good guy, Thomas Rainer. He is a scripting guy, he is an MVP, and he is not single, ladies. I'm sorry.
And he loves cats.
And he loves cats. And you know what even works better for an introduction? If we actually are on ourselves. And there we are, because Thomas was just sitting up there all by himself.
You guys are eating into my trick time.
And so, you know, Marcos, if you had to list out like your number one top PowerShell tricks, like what would your number one top PowerShell trick be?
First of all, download for the next 72 hours the PowerShell book.
Do I just have to be louder?
Just follow the MVP hour hashtag, and you get the book for free for 72 hours.
That's actually not how you get the book for free. You go on Amazon, amazon.com, and you just look up Master PowerShell Tricks. That's with a T and an R. Ends with an S. Master PowerShell Tricks, Volume 2, is yours for the next 72 hours. Help us become number one on Amazon.
Go get it.
Go get it, Thomas.
All right. Sorry you guys had to put up with that. I'm going to show you a whole bunch of tricks that are actually not very stupid at all. So you're here under false pretenses if you thought you were going to get stupid PowerShell tricks. Like Dave and Marco said, you can find me on Twitter, LinkedIn. I'm an honorary scripting guy. I'm a Microsoft MVP for PowerShell. And this is only a two-slide presentation. Stupid trick number zero. If you're ever going to do a scripting demo, make sure at the beginning of your script you do something that prevents you from accidentally running the whole script. That way, you can do one of those. Okay, now, let us...
Hold on.
No.
Let's get into... We're going to zoom in on this.
Terrific.
Watch this.
No, you're killing all the learning time. You good? Okay. So... Everybody knows this, like, what's the first thing you do when you fire up like a DOS prompt when you're a kid and you're playing with a computer? You go DIR, you see the directory listing, and then you go change directory, you go somewhere else, and how fun and exciting. And so in PowerShell, you have get child item, right? You can even go get child item, pipe it into select star, and get a whole bunch more stuff about all of the different things you have there. So just what you saw above. This isn't all the information. You go select star to see all the information that comes with that. And I can select just regular items here, right? I can get full name, creation time, last write time, not blowing anybody's mind here. If you've used PowerShell before, you've probably seen something like this happen. But I love this table. This is my favorite table in the whole world, except I wish it had one more column. I wish it had a column right here that told me the difference between the creation time and the last write time. But alas, that is not one of the properties that I get when I do select object star. So how can I get that right in the table where I like it? Well, I can use a calculated property. These are all just different properties that I'm returning, and I can calculate one on the fly as I'm doing my select object. I still have my get child item, I still pipe it into select object, still have full name, creation time, last write time, and then whoa, something weird, different. Here is a calculated property. It's just a hash table. It's a hash table with a label and difference between write and create, and an expression, which is a script block. Kind of works like a for each loop or a for each object loop or a where object, where it references the dollar underscore variable for PS item. And I'm just doing new time span between the creation and the last write. So when I run this, now I get my full name, creation time, last write time, and difference between write and create. Pretty handy. You can use this to mix and match stuff where I want to get a list of Active Directory users, and I want to get a property that's only available on their Exchange Online mailbox. And I can do my get AD user, and then I can do a calculated property for this is their mailbox quota or something like that. And I can do that all in one line, all in one select object statement, and then I can pass that on down the pipeline as a single object. Pretty neat. Now, let's just write a change to the file, prove to you that this works. There it is. And if I run it again, it's a different time than it was before. Stupid trick number one. So I should say I kind of glossed over the intro because our punch drunk hosts insisted on chewing up as much of your time as they could. You're not going to take every single one of these tricks and go, oh, that's the best thing I've ever seen. But the goal of this session is to save you some head scratching down the road, and that you'll see three or four things where you go, oh, I didn't know that. That's cool. I'm going to use that, and it'll improve your workflow. Let's do a GetSim class Win32 operating system. Again, not blowing anybody's mind here with this one. Just getting operating system information about my local machine. But again, this isn't all of the properties that gets returned when I do a GetSim class Win32 operating system. To see what they are, I can pipe it into select star, but maybe there's methods here as well. Maybe this object has methods, like to change it to a string or change it to something else or set a property. To see what they all are, I can pipe it into GetMember. And you can see here, it returns a sim class object. It's got equals and hash code. This isn't a very interesting one to look at, but if you had Active Directory objects or Exchange objects, some of these have methods built in. And you can see all the different properties. You can see sim class name is a script property, so it's a calculated thing that gets made up. The other thing I can do is go get command get sim class. And then I say, okay, it's a commandlet, it's version 1, and it came from my sim commandlet source. But again, there's more to this one than that. I can pipe that into select star, and I can see a whole bunch of other stuff. I can see where the help URL is if I wanted to go that way. I can see that this is a DLL, or here's where the DLL is. So this is a compiled module that gives me this commandlet. A bunch of information about the help, about the definition. Where's the one I'm looking for? The command type is commandlet, so I know it's compiled. If this said function, I know it came from a module or a script. And I'll show you an example of that in a second. The source, this is where it came from. This is the module or the DLL. It's called sim commandlets. And parameters. You can see all the different parameters that it takes. And one thing I can see here is it's truncated, right? This isn't all the parameters. It's wrapped in curly braces and it's got these three dots. So if I do a select expand property parameters, I can see this is actually all the parameters that it takes. So when you see something wrapped in curly braces like that, where'd it go? And with the three dots, you know it's being truncated and there's more there than it's showing you on the screen. So you can expand that property and get all that information out of it. But let's look at more about get command. Let's say I have, here's my really super powerful, awesome, so good you'd think Dave wrote it function, where it's invoke test, writes output, I did it. And what do you think it does? It wrote, did it. Dave, do you know how I did that? I used my fingers on the keyboard and typed it out. So now,
What fun is that?
I can go get command, invoke test, select star, just like I did to get sim class. But it looks pretty different now, right? I'm gonna make this a little bigger. I can see, I don't have any help built in for this. I have a script block, I have a commandlet binding, etc. But what's really interesting here is I have definition. And it just says write output, did it. And I'll come back to that in a second. It's got my verb and noun.
So if you can keep the white out of there, we can't really see much on the top on the white, but we can see the blue.
I'll try. Yeah, that's about as much as I can do.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay.
But we can see that fine.
Okay. And it gives you some other information about it. What's really interesting though is, oh, I just did that. If I just get the definition parameter, like I said, this is what the function actually does. So if you're working with a big module, it's hundreds of lines, it's dozens of files, and it's got functions declared all over the place, and you just want to pick apart one, and you want to see how it works, and damned if you can find the actual text in the file that has the definition, import the module, do get command, the command and look at the definition, because that'll tell you exactly what it's doing. You can pipe this out to a file and look at it, and then you can dissect it right from there. So something that in some module I wrote, it's got 4,000 commandlets or something, or functions, I should say. Now, if I'm just interested in how one works, because I want to reverse engineer it, or I want to manipulate it and use it in my own script without having to do a whole bunch of weirdness, I can get exactly what it's running from get command. It'll tell me automatically. So let's look more. Here's thing one, it's an item. Here's thing two, it's an array of items, right? If I write out thing one and then thing two, it looks like three lines of text, right? Nothing really crazy happening here. But what I want to show you is, if I do thing one and pipe it into get member, it looks like it's a string. It is a string, no surprises there. But if I do a thing two and pipe that into get member, bit of a spoiler alert in the comment, what does that look like? Thing two, get member, it's not a string, it's an array. It's got strings in it, but here it says it's a string. That's weird. And all of these methods and properties that you see belong to those of a string. So get member is lying to me and I don't like it. Let's figure out what's going on here. Let's have an array. Thing three is going to be an array with an integer, a string, and a PS custom object that should get translated to a string as well. And put that into get member. Thanks, guys. That's not distracting at all. This one says it's a string, and it says it's an integer. So what's happening here? It's taking whatever the output of thing three is and piping that into get member. So it's saying, okay, I have an integer and a string. I'm going to write those to the pipeline and then pipe those into get member. So I'm not actually doing a get member on the object. I'm doing a get member on the output of what happens when I write that object. So how do I know what my objects are then? I know what's in my collections, but what if I need to tell the difference between an array of strings and a single string? I could look at the count or something, but what's better is doing get type. Thing1.getType, right there, boom, it's a string, it's base type, a system object. How about thing2, what's that? That's an array of objects. And that way I can tell, is this a string, is this an array of objects, who cares? And why would I care? Here's thing one with something appended to it. Now, if I thought thing two was just another string, and I did a plus equals, it's valid PowerShell, that's fine. But what does my output look like now? I get, predictably, this is an item with something added on, that's thing one. And then thing two echoes out that array, and then it appended another item to my array. Maybe that was, excuse me, maybe that wasn't the behavior that I actually expected. With using get type, I'll know definitively what similar operations actually do on disparate objects. Let's look at one that people usually don't know about and they like kind of a lot. Here I'm just running some commands. I'm writing write output. I'm going to do write verbose and write warning. And now a reminder to actually demo the part that's interesting. So I'm going to clear the host, and it's a little hard with the podium, but the trick here is I could up arrow my way through these and okay, finally get there, but maybe it's really far up, maybe I went by it and now I'm down, and who knows, doing the up arrow thing is not a lot of fun. What I can do is hit the pound sign, hashtag, number sign, whatever you want to call it, and then start writing part of my command and tab complete it. And it'll give me the last one that matches that beginning of the command. If I hit tab again, it gives me my write verbose. So it's going back through my command history that matches the part of the command that I wrote. Wrote write output, and now I'm all the way back at my function, right? I can run that, and there it is. I can go write v. Now that should only match the write verbose part, right? And indeed it does. And I could come in here and go again. Then it just does it again. So it's a really slick way of looking through my command history, because it'll do the partial match depending on how much of the command I type out. So if you're doing a whole bunch of different Active Directory commands, and then you did a whole bunch of Exchange commands, and you go, oh, I want to get that Active Directory command I did, but it was like, oh man, I felt like I typed forever. You just go get ADU, whatever it was, and you can tab complete your way through just the get Active Directory user commands or something. And that's really handy when you're flipping around in the shell a lot. This doesn't just work in PowerShell ISE, this works in the console as well. That's a fun one, I like that one a lot. And I use it constantly. Here, new one, the rules for format table, format list, and outgrid view is one people don't always know about. Here, I'm just gonna do a get WMI object, Win32 operating system, and I'm getting four properties. I'm getting the computer name, the caption, the architecture, and the registered user. Big whoop. And this is my new favorite table ever. It's better than the first one that I said was my favorite table, except I want it to also have the version. It's kind of hard to see here, but it's also going to get the version. And I really like the table format, right? And I didn't specify in either one of these what the format should be, but the first one was a table, so the second one should be a table too, right? Wrong. Got me my version. This is all the information I wanted. This is awesome. Now I have all that stuff, but I'm pretty disappointed it's not in a table because maybe I didn't just have one item. Maybe I had like 60 of these and I didn't want to look at 60 lists. I wanted to look at one table of 60 items. Well, why? Why did this come out as a list? Why didn't this come out as a table? The rule, people don't always know, by default, if you have four properties or fewer, you get a table. If you have five properties or more, you get a list. Now, there's things that override that. Like if I do get child item, you can see there's this thing up here, and maybe get child item only has a few, but this is a custom format here, and different functions and modules and commandlets can override that behavior. But in general, four or fewer, table, five or more, list. But using format list and format table, I can override that output or that behavior. So here's my four item list, and here's my five item table that I really like. And the point here is, like, most people know about format list and format table. They're not really brand new commands, and they are usually some of the first ones that you bump into, but they take processing time. They can be helpful or not in certain situations, and so it's good to know when you'll get auto format as a table or as a list. The other one that I can show you here is outgrid view. This is for free in PowerShell. If you just run the same thing like it was being piped into format list or table, but into outgrid view, I get this cool GUI right here. Dave would love this. It's a shame he had to step out. But I get my table information, and I get a filter here. I'll show you a better example of how to take advantage of that. Here I'm doing a get child item and I'm piping it into outgrid view, OGV. It's kind of like FT or FL is for format table, format list. This is outgrid view. And so cool, I get all my output that I get from get child item, but it's in a GUI. And I can even go in here and I can go test two, and it filtered it just to the test2.txt that's there. I can even go by the time, I think 49 is the only one that has that as test one. I can come back in here and add criteria as well to do more deliberate filtering. So my name, it contains two. I can make that a more elaborate thing as well. And I get all this filtering right here. And so if I have like 40 of these things to look at, 40 files, and I don't want to have to scroll through output or pipe it to a CSV file or something, I can just pipe it to outgrid view and work with it right here dynamically. And oh, I want the rest of my data back. Well, there it is. I just clear my filters and there it is. This is standard vanilla PowerShell. It comes with it. You don't have to install anything or get a new module or anything like that at all. It's just for free and people don't always know it's there. How are we doing? Let's talk about history some more. Here's a really long command. Oh, that took a long time to type and I'd hate to do it again. But what I can do here, I'm even just going to type it in the keyboard. I would like to run that again. I want to do it again. I can just go R, enter, and it runs that same command over again. Pretty cool. It's not a trick. I didn't just set that up as an alias. Here I did a different command. I go R, enter, and that does the other one. It's running the last piece of code that I ran. So what's R? It's an alias for invoke history. that's built right into PowerShell again. Excuse me. And you can run that, and it'll just keep running whatever the last thing you ran was, R. It's doing the get alias on R now. I could do a get history to see what's actually in there. I probably shouldn't have run that so many times because this might look like a lot of get aliases, but I'm sorting it by descending, so I get my most recent ones first, and I'm just getting the first 10. So I've got my get aliases, and I've got write output, but there's an ID column too, which is pretty helpful because what I can do is do R and then a number. So let's go R and then 47. That's one of my write outputs, right? Well, that's pretty cool because invoke history will take one of those IDs and can run that just based off the ID number. So I could, maybe it's 20 commands ago, or I don't know, it's in the last 50, and they're all really similar to each other, so I don't want to use the hashtag and typing tab completion. I can just get this list of items that I've run and then run the one that I want to run again.
Can you change those if you imagine that you made a mistake? Just want to come back and you don't want to press the up arrow?
Kind of. The question was for the people in the video, can you change items in your history? And the answer is not really, but you can do what I'm about to show you, and that's do R and then set clipboard. That will put the output to the clipboard. So if I did R47 and then piped it to SCB is an alias for set clipboard. That will put the output on my clipboard, but I could do a get history, what did I say, 47? And I could do a, I could wrap this and go command line, get over here. I could put that on my clipboard, and then I could edit it from there and run it again. You can't edit the history directly because it's an audit trail of what you've actually run, but you can get just the command line out of that, and then you could pipe that to your clipboard and then paste it somewhere and then edit that. Like if I did that and piped it into set clipboard, then I could paste it here, and I could go fixed and run it again. So it's a handy way to get those commands back, because you could come in here and I'm on a touchpad, so it's really hard to highlight, and or you could just use the command line to do your work for you. And like I said, SCB, alias for set clipboard, that's new in PowerShell 5. Let's go past this one. Here's a fun one. The difference between dot split and dash split. So here I've got a string. It's an interesting string with S's and T's and a whole bunch of characters. And I want to make an array of this string where I'm just going to break it apart everywhere there's an S, right? Dot split. Now, there was a S in this, so it split it in there. There was an S in is, so it split it there. And I'm getting an array of all the places on either side of an S. That's what dot split's doing. If I do a split on T, I get the same thing, except it's breaking it apart everywhere there's a T. That's what dot split does. So that'll take a string and split it into an array depending on what I put in here. Now, let's get crazy. Let's go wild and split it anywhere there's an S and a T. So I'm going to remind you, this is our string. So there's lots of T's and S's, but the only way there's an S followed by a T is in interesting and in string. I'll save you the analysis here. Those are the only two places that it should break this string apart. So if I run that, ooh, what happened there? Well, let's try dash split. That acted like I expect. The difference between dot split and dash split is that dot split takes an array of characters as an argument. It says anywhere there's an S or that there's a T, I'm going to split it up. Dash split takes a regular expression or a string and treats it like I wanted it to treat it in my example here. So that's something that you'll beat your head against a wall for hours trying to figure out, going, I'm using dot split, it splits it on S, that's easy. Now I just want to split it on ST and it's not working, it's so frustrating. Dash split will take the string argument or a regular expression, whereas dot split just takes a character array. Trim works the same way. So again, let me remind you that the split string is this. I'm going to trim characters off the front and the back. And I don't have this sequence of characters anywhere. But what happens is it's trimming all of the I's, E's, C's, H's, and T's off of each end of my string until it gets to a character that's not in this array of characters. So if you wanted to trim the word this off of the front, you'd have to find another way to do it. Here's a thing with get random. Okay, I want a random number between 1 and 10, right? And here all I'm doing is I'm getting 10 random numbers, minimum 1, maximum 10, and I'm just joining them together so that it looks nice. It looks like this. Goes, okay, there's 10 numbers between 1 and 10. Does anyone notice anything weird about my 10 random numbers between 1 and 10? No? No, they're random. Let me illustrate the point a little more neatly. I'm gonna get 250 of them. Seeing it? It's been a long day, it's okay, we're right about to hit the bar. There's no 10. Interesting, isn't it? Let me really hit the nail on the head. Here, between 1 and 2, they're all 1s. That's weird, isn't that weird? I was trying to figure, here's how I found this one. I had exchange servers 1 through 6, and I wanted to pick a random server 1 through 6. So I figured I'd do a get random, minimum 1, maximum 6. Well, what it's doing is it's taking greater than or equal to the minimum and less than the maximum, not equal to. So if I want a random number between 1 and 2, I gotta go minimum 1, maximum 3, and there's my random 1s and 2s. That is actually documented, but why the heck would you read the documentation for get random? Like, and I should say, like, if you, get random can also take an array. So if you said my input object is an array of servers and I want to just get a random one, that it'll still pick from the entire array. It's just that it won't take the maximum value out of here. When you do minimum 1, maximum 2, you'll get all 1s out of it, and that's really frustrating when it's been like an hour and a half and you can't figure out why the thing's broken. Let me show you confirm and what if. Some people do and don't know that this exists. Here, I'm going to create a new item, but I want to, this is a line in a script a service desk user is going to run for me, and I'm going to confirm. Did you want to do that for sure? Now I get this confirm box. And if I say no, doesn't create it. Helpful. And by default, new item's not going to prompt me. It only prompted me because I put in dash confirm built into PowerShell and most commandlets that actually have an impact. Here is another one, dash what if. It's going to show me what if I ran this. It says performing operation create file on destination, but it didn't actually make it either. This is a really handy way to see, hey, I'm going to use delete AD object to delete 6 users based on a specific criteria that I get in the pipeline upstream. Let's see what it's actually going to do first. And you'd get a list says deleting Active Directory object, the distinguished name, et cetera, et cetera. And it wouldn't actually do it because you used what if. Now, I should say, you can't bank on what if. Like, that's not going to, don't let it be your career saver. Like, if you're doing something really dangerous and you want to make sure that, hey, I'm not going to blow up my environment, then take a little bit more precaution than just putting what if on it. But it's super handy to use. The other thing I want to show you is PS default parameter values. This is a way that you can put in default values for parameters that get applied to whatever the criteria is every time you run it. So I'll explain with an example. I'm adding an item to my PS default parameter values, and it's every time I call new item, that's the command, colon parameter confirm, I want it to be true. So what I'm doing here is I get the command, the parameter on the other side of the colon, and then the value that I want it to be. And so what that does is it adds an item to my default parameter values. And now I'm going to run new item, and I'm not going to put the confirm flag in there. But it's going to confirm me anyway. Because it's going, hey, every time I run new item, I want confirm to be true. And now if I say no, it's not going to be there. And maybe you're writing a script for a service desk user to do whatever you want, and you want them to get confirmed every time it happens, but you don't want to have to put confirm in there every time, or you're worried you might miss one, or You want this just to happen where they're running things from the command line. Now you can add it to their PS default parameter values for them. If you want to get rid of the stuff you've put in there, go clear. One of the places that I use PS default parameters a lot is when I'm working with Active Directory, because I'll be logged in as a non-privileged user, and I'll open PowerShell as a non-privileged user, but I'll want to interact with the Active Directory commands as a privileged user. So I'll import module Active Directory, and it's loaded, but I'm still not privileged. What I can do is make a credential object just by going like creds equals get credential, and I'm just going to put gibberish in here. And now those credentials are stored in creds. If I go creds, it's got my username and password. And almost all of the Active Directory commandlets have a dash credential parameter that will let me run that command with different credentials than the ones I'm logged in with. So I'll be logged in as a non-privileged user, running PowerShell as a non-privileged user, imported Active Directory as a non-privileged user, and then every time I run a get or anything from the Active Directory module, I want to supply credential and then my credential variable. So it's running all those Active Directory commands as my privileged user. Here's one you can do if you want to be a jerk. I'm going to do this to Dave later when he's not looking. Star what if true. So everything I run, that I want the what if flag to be true, because I'm a jerk. Now, if I do a get child item, it just runs. Why didn't it use what if? Well, because this doesn't have any impact. All I did was get data. There was nothing at stake here. All it was going to do was return information for me. So there's no what if to be had. But new item, okay. Ooh, what if? I didn't specify what if, but everything has what if here. And it just keeps doing it. You can't override it though. So even if for some reason they don't have permission to change their PS default parameters, you can just specify dash what if false, and it'll create it. You can override it. This is not a security measure. This is not something that your auditors will be so glad you did. This is something for convenience or annoying Dave. Now I'm gonna clear those out. But they're really flexible and they're really powerful, and especially when you're working with the same parameters over and over again and you want to save yourself typing them in, you can. The other thing to know here too is you can override these by specifying them at all. So if I did, you saw it right here. I had what if is true, and here I explicitly said what if was false, and it took the value that I provided. So it's default parameter value. It's the parameter it's going to use if I don't give it one. I can only imagine the stuff you're putting in the lower third of the screen right now.
No, actually, I'm just I'm generating a tweet right now that'll go in there that just tells people that we just hit number one on Amazon Kindle.
Oh,
thank
nice.
Thank you very much.
We're running low on time, so I wanted to get to another one here. This one's silly, and here's why this is one I want to show you. What do a lot of people do? They go output of a command equals get command, whatever. This is the thing that I'm running. And then they go if out, then something else, something else, right? People do that, right? They go if this. They go if the output of the command. That's wrong. That's bad. You don't do that. And I'll show you why, and I'll show you the right way. And here's why you don't do that. The if block is looking for something that equals true. So if this is true, then it goes into the if block. If it's false, then it goes into the else block, right? This is how if else works. This is branching 101 here. But maybe my output is an empty string. Is my empty string false? Sure, it is. Okay. Now, here's where it gets messed up. False equals my empty string, but does my empty string equal false? No. The heck? I don't even know why it does this. I just know that it screws me up if I'm trying to use it as validation in my scripts. So does true equal an empty string? No. Does an empty string equal true? Also no. I'm going to go through the rest of these pretty quickly. False equals null. True equals null. Null equals true. Null equals false. Empty string null. Null equals empty string. Guess what? They're all false. None of these things equal each other. So that's why if you're going, if something, then do it. That's the wrong way of validating if there's a value in the variable you're looking at. Because the value could be null. That's not true, and it's not false. It's null. Is it an empty string? Well, that's not null. It's not true, and it's not false. So it's the wrong way to be validating your parameters. So here, could be empty is an empty string. There's no space in there. It's just two quotes, and it's closed. This is what you should do. String is null or empty. That's true. It's built right into the string accelerator. And it will tell me, is that string null or is that string empty? And it'll return true if it is. So my if statement should be if string is null or empty and then the string. Or if not string is null or empty, then do whatever. And that's the proper way to tell if I should be entering my if statement or not. There's also is null or white space, which works like you'd think it would, so it'll detect if there's multiple spaces. And to be clear, could be empty is an empty string, right? Is it false? No. Is it true? Still no. So if I was going if could be empty, I would never get into my if block, even though there's a value there or not. Now could be empty is just a bunch of spaces. It's white space. And to show you, is null or empty? It's not. It's not empty and it's not null. It's a bunch of white space, but is null or white space will still catch it. So that's the difference between those two. And that is how you should be looking at your if blocks and your while blocks. Like while there's a value in this variable, do this, you may never hit it. So, and here, look, this is still false. And this is still false. All the white space in the world is not true and it's not false. And that could really screw up a script. So I'm going to stop it there. There's more stupid tricks to be had. And this slide deck and the demo file is available for download on my GitHub repository, github.com/thomasrenner.com/presentation-files. You'll find the PowerShell tricks folder for this presentation, and this .ps1 is in there. And you can go through it line by line. It doesn't come with my commentary, but if you have any questions about it or you see something in there that you want to talk about, find me on Twitter, find me on LinkedIn, comment on my blog.
This is recorded on Facebook MVP site. It'll be there like in 5 minutes.
Okay, and you can go check it out on the Facebook MVP site. Thanks, Dave.
It'll get the commentary.
Oh, yeah, for this. I was talking about the other tricks that are in there that I scrolled past or didn't get to today. So I'll cut it short here. This was one that's kind of designed just to go until we're out of time and that we'll never get through the entire thing, which is why I kind of rank them in order that I like them. But we are almost ready to go celebrate St. Patrick's Day. There's one more session after this, and I think the bar just opened, so... enjoy the rest of the conference. Me and the other MVPs will be around answering questions and talking about all things IT. And enjoy the rest of your day. I hope you learned something valuable from this and other sessions.